books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to part one of a two-part Christmas special of Read On, the audiobook show featuring the Map Men and their book, This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters. Plus, we'll find some brand new Christmas books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
The Map Men are the duo of Jay Foreman and Mark Cooper Jones, known for their YouTube series and their brand new book that explores cartography, maps and geography in an entertaining and educational way. The book This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters came out in November and it's now in the RNIB Talking Books Library and in all good bookshops. Jay and Mark will be along in a moment to discuss the book, and I even introduced them twice, and we'll chat about the quirks of making a very visual book into an audiobook. Let's hear more from Jay and Mark as they read from the introduction of This Way Up.
So, without further ado, let's read our book.
Skip contents, skip blank pages, that's the title again. Ah! Introduction. In the words of famous American geographer Marc Monbonnier, maps are like milk. Their information is perishable, and it's wise to check the date. It can sometimes be difficult to find a date, but often, if you check the back...
Hang on, we should probably be clear about something before we go any further. See, we're not actually historians, or cartographers, or cartographic historians, or mapmakers, or geographers, or researchers, or academics. Our claim to cartographic authority is a video series on YouTube called Map Men, where the two of us, Mark Cooper Jones on the left in a blue shirt, Jay Foreman on the right in a lighter blue shirt, sit behind a desk and talk about our favourite maps, occasionally dressing up in costumes and acting out the stories behind them in silly sketches. You don't need to have seen it. This book is not a sequel.
Now, RNIB Connect Radio also broadcasts Read On, so we're bound by Ofcom rules, so we can't say the C word on this show, in saying that. I'm joined by Mark Cooper Jones and Jay Foreman, a pair of comedy cartographers concocting clever commentary on confusing, contorted countries, chronicling countless cryptic, crooked, and catastrophically convoluted counties, and confidently critiquing curiosities with contagious charisma. Please welcome the Map Men.
Hello.
Hello.
Two things. First of all, thank you so much for having us. And second of all, that is far and away the best introduction I think we've ever had.
The last person who got an introduction like that was on Star Trek. So, yeah.
Do you know what? I just completely missed it. I've literally just managed to get my headphones on.
You missed a confounding concoction of lovely alliteration.
I'll do it again.
Just for Mark,
that's
yeah.
That's all right.
Just for Mark.
Sorry, I ran downstairs because I realised I needed headphones to make this work. And yeah, hopefully it's all good. Sorry.
I'm joined by Mark Cooper Jones and Jay Foreman, a pair of comedy cartographers, concocting clever commentary on confusing, contorted countries, chronicling countless cryptic, crooked and catastrophically convoluted counties, and confidently critiquing curiosities with contagious charisma. Please welcome the Map Men.
Wow. Thank you very much.
You see, Mark, it was good.
I bet you couldn't do that again if you tried, though, Robert.
It's especially impressive that it wasn't scripted.
Oh, yeah. It's completely off the cuff there. So let's start with a big, dumb, jumping-off elevator pitch question. Tell us about This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters.
This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters is the book version of our YouTube series. So Map Men is a comedy sketch show where each episode is about a different map that we found. So we tell funny stories about maps, and it's a combination of us sitting behind the desk talking about the map and us dressing up in silly costumes and acting out the sketches. We get compared quite often to horrible histories, but we're doing it for geography and maps. And so we got approached by some publishers and they said, would you like to write a book? And we were far too polite to say no. We said, yes, please. And we went about the business of how do we turn 10-minute silly sketches into something people can read? And so we decided to go for a book all about the best times throughout history when maps have gone wrong in some way. So whether it's a border in the wrong place or made up mountain range or maps being made deliberately wrong on purpose for all sorts of hilarious reasons. And we managed 16 chapters. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah, I think that's right. 16 plus an introduction and a bibliography. We started from the idea, our initial idea was maps that would get you lost, wasn't it? I think that was sort of our working title, you know, 22 or whatever we thought we might end up with, maps to get you lost, because we really just liked the, you know, the central paradox there was just obviously something we could have fun with. And then a little way down the line, the publishers said, why not just make this a bit more obvious and just make it maps that have gone wrong? Because that's essentially what it is. And we completely agreed. So that's where we ended up.
While it is true that our meaningful geographic credentials are limited, specifically...
Mark got a degree in geography from the University of Durham, 2-1, was a geography teacher for 3 years, didn't like the students, has a lapsed fellowship of the Royal Geographical Society.
Jay spent his teenage years reading the London A to Z. There's one factor that qualifies us to venture beyond our usual platform and politely elbow our way into the grown-up map section of a proper bookshop. We really love maps. And if making silly videos about them for nearly 10 years has taught us anything, it's that it turns out we're not alone. Interest in maps appears to be on the rise. On a functional level, most of us are using maps more than ever before, thanks to smartphones, while at the other end of the technology spectrum, the antique, collectible map market has been growing apace, with people increasingly drawn to their aesthetic, their stories, and their sheer stare-at-ableness. And it's not just the wealthy art-collecting crowd who like to gawp. The subreddit r/mapporn has 6.1 million members, putting it in the top 1% of subreddits by size.
Footnote, we recognise that there may be some wealthy art-collecting types on Reddit too, but surely not 6.1 million.
There are lots of reasons why people enjoy looking at maps. Beauty, curiosity, navigation, a desire to understand the spatial dimensions of a set of data, spotting your own house. But in our opinion, there's no map more thrilling than a map that's got something wrong.
So when the book launches in New Zealand, how are you going to find it?
Well, if New Zealand is missing on most maps of the world, which is something we discovered, we spoke to some people in New Zealand and we're very relieved to hear that they were pleased with the chapter we wrote about why New Zealand goes missing from maps all the time and why, when it does, it's so funny. And it's something we talk about in the book, the fact that New Zealand going missing from maps all the time is something that they have taken in their stride and they're strangely proud of it. Like, going missing from a map is their thing.
It's such a testament to Kiwis, isn't it, and their mentality that it almost fits with the sort of New Zealand psyche, I think, that they get left off and then they just enjoy that fact. And I think if you think about any other nation, maybe not any other nation, but certainly some certain
if you think about Britain,
if you think about Britain, and then, you know, not that dissimilar in size, I suppose, being left off a world map, it's not like we just sort of laugh about it and take it in our stride and enjoy it somehow and just sort of chip in on a Reddit group, Maps Without Britain, we'd be apoplectic. I mean,
oh yeah. And the funny thing is, it's the New Zealand government themselves are in on the joke. If you go to the New Zealand government website, whenever there's an error 404 page, so for a website that's for a page that's missing, they have their own Map Without New Zealand and a subtitle that says something is missing. And there was also, we talk about it in the book as well, there was a genuinely funny series of campaign videos by Visit New Zealand. And it was all about this great conspiracy to remove New Zealand from world maps. And starring in this video were none other than Jacinda Ardern, the then Prime Minister of New Zealand, and Peter Jackson off of Lord of the Rings. So, you know, they know about it and they take it very seriously and they take it not very seriously at all.
New Zealand missing from maps is an obvious mistake, but some maps, as it says in the book, may be wrong on purpose, either for malicious purposes or just for clicks.
That's right. Yeah, we really wanted to include a range of different types of stories of maps going wrong. You know, we didn't want them all to be, oh, you know, I suppose back in the day, they just didn't have satellite technology. And therefore, isn't it funny that they drew the line in the wrong place again? And now we know where it really is. And ha 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 ha. Instead, we wanted to have a real mix of kind of some modern stories and some older stories as well. And yes, in some cases, the mistakes being fully intentional. Probably couldn't list them all off the top of my head, but two quick examples would be the example of paper towns, or sometimes known as trap streets, which is this great phenomenon. We had to include a chapter about this, which is where essentially making a map takes a very long time, you know, collecting that data, doing the survey. It's very expensive work. And how do you stop somebody else just looking at your map and just drawing the same lines and maybe annotating it in different colors and all the rest of it? How do you protect copyright in map making? One of those ways is through putting in fake details, things that aren't really there, that only you would know was fake because you'd carried out the survey. So it might be a street with a slightly misspelt name, or it might be a street that's not there at all. Or in some cases, they put entire towns in sort of remote areas or villages, perhaps, that weren't really there. That can be really fun. And at the other end of the spectrum, I suppose, was our chapter on a Soviet mapping exercise. And we simply had to include this because I think there has probably never been as large a scale or organised intentional wrong mapping project as that undertaken sort of first by Stalin, but really throughout the decades of the Cold War, where there was not only enormous levels of censorship on the maps, but a lot of intentionally putting roads, towns, cities in the wrong place, for the sole reason that these maps might end up in the hands of enemy spies, American spies, that there could be the Cold War could turn into a hot war one day, and that it was just for misdirection purposes and to make sure that people wouldn't know where to aim their missiles should it come to that. But it was carried out at great expense to the civil agencies who did it, and obviously it was incredibly inconvenient for anybody in the Soviet Union who needed to use these maps. And obviously maps are extremely useful things for when you're building things, construction, utilities, military operations, just going on a hike, all the rest of it. But they were singularly unreliable Soviet maps at that time. And the more we looked at that, the more that sort of started to unravel and the scale of it became apparent to us.
The more you look into it, the funnier it gets. And I think the most extraordinary thing about this story of the Soviet maps making them wrong on purpose was that it was completely pointless. Towards the end of the Cold War, they knew full well that the Americans had satellite technology. I mean, they knew this because they had satellites of their own. So they were making these deliberately wrong maps, and the only purpose it served was to make their own citizens lost. So we thought, we've got to tell this story, because I think something that bad maps all have in common, they're really funny. And usually when a map has got something wrong with it, there's a funny story behind it.
We should clarify what we mean by wrong, because if we're splitting hairs, every single map ever made is, by definition, wrong. To quote Marc Monmonier again, not only is it easy to lie with maps, it is essential. What he means is, no map can possibly be entirely accurate. A map's job is to take a bit of the real world and translate it into something useful, using their three defining features of scale, symbols, and projection, each of which is a form of distortion. For a map to contain no distortion at all, it would have to be both three-dimensional and at a scale of 1:1, which is of very limited use. What we mean by maps that have gone wrong is maps with big, stinking, awful map blunders, like a country that's gone missing, or a fictional mountain range, or a misdrawn border that crosses all sorts of boundaries. The sort of mistakes that could lead to the unfortunate map user getting hopelessly lost. We love them because they provoke the question, what on earth happened here? And the answer is most often a fascinating story.
And more from Jay and Mark, the Map Men, in a moment. But talking of fascinating stories, let me direct you to some brand new Christmas books that have entered the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. Murder at Midwinter by Ada Moncrief was donated by Penguin Random House.
The village of Midwinter had never cared much for ostentation. Not for it the fripperies and trifles of an Easter parade, nor anything so vulgar as participating in the annual Villages in Bloom competition that had so many of its neighbouring hamlets chomping at the bit come June of every year.
December 1937. Daphne King is attending the 20th anniversary reunion at her secondary school, Midwinter Academy, a weekend that will see resurrected rivalries and alliances amidst the Christmas festivities. But a string of peculiar incidents prompts Daphne to suspect that she and her friends are being sent messages, or threats, related to the disappearance of a classmate 20 years ago. It was a mystery that clouded their final year at school, and one which Daphne, as a budding 18-year-old sleuth, solved. When, the morning after the reunion, one of Daphne's old school friends is found dead, Daphne finds herself in the role of investigator once more. Are the two cases linked? And has Daphne learned from the mistakes of her past?
No. Midwinter and its denizens, many of whom had resided there so long that the local public house had been the site where they had mourned the death of Queen Victoria, prided themselves on a sense of understated propriety and studiously maintained self-possession. It was a village in which net curtains were never twitched. The post office queue confined itself merely to inconsequential commentary on the weather and pleasantries exchanged with the most pleasant and therefore forgettable nature.
Murder at Midwinter by Ada Moncrief is narrated by Daphne Kuma and runs for 5 hours and 22 minutes.
The Christmas Magpie by Mark Edwards was given to us by Penguin Random House.
The first parcel was waiting on the doorstep when Noel got home from work. It was the beginning of December and a chill hung in the air, the faintest promise of snow, although Noel wasn't quite that optimistic. He was 30 years old and had never experienced a white Christmas, but if it did happen this year, it would be the almost literal icing on the cake, because Noel had already decided that this was going to be the best Christmas ever.
It's Noel and Danny's first Christmas in their new home, and they want everything to be perfect. Lavish presents, a beautiful tree, and outdoor decorations to join in with the festivities in this welcoming community. But they quickly wonder if this street is as perfect as it appears. First, there are the unwelcome presents left anonymously on their doorstep. Then they're sure that someone is watching them. And why are the neighbours all obsessed with a notorious killer who's housed at a nearby women's prison? After tragedy strikes at a Christmas party, Noel and Danny try to find out who is targeting them. But in this case, it might be safer not to know.
He picked the parcel up. It was the shape, size, and approximate weight of a large box of chocolates, wrapped in shiny red paper with a pattern of gold holly leaves. A matching red ribbon was tied around it. He shook it gently and read the gift tag that was attached to it, handwritten in block capitals. A little something to welcome you to the neighborhood. Love, Secret Santa, Kiss.
The Christmas Magpie by Mark Edwards is narrated by Imogen Church and Theo Solomon and runs for 4 hours and 39 minutes.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
That number again for the RNIB helpline, it's not just to join the library, but it's 0303 123 9999. Now let's return to my chat with Jay Foreman and Mark Cooper-Jones.
It's good to be lost. Or at least, it's good to be forced to think about your surroundings and consider where you are in relation to the wider world. And what better way to do so than to sample a sumptuous selection of fabulously faulty maps? Of course, reading this book won't get you lost.
Listening to this audiobook won't get you lost.
Listening to this audiobook won't get you lost, at least it shouldn't, but as more of us start to question the benefits of life under big tech, perhaps it might act as a timely ode to disorientation, a paean to the unknown. A bit pompous that, but then I am incredibly pompous and I wrote that bit. In the following chapters, we've selected what we believe to be some of the very best wrong maps. Some of them are decades old, some are centuries old, and some are so recent they're still being published today, or yesterday if you're listening to this tomorrow. They include colonial maps, collaborative maps, corporate maps, Soviet maps, pioneer maps, news maps, and maps whose intended use was hijacked for a surrealist political movement, as well as a few others that weren't easy to write punctually into a list. Some chapters tell the stories of unforeseen map errors, others of intentional errors. For one of them, we even went on a little field trip, which was hardly necessary, but old habits die hard, especially for ex-geography teachers.
For a pair of cartophiles like us, finding, researching, and writing these stories while staring at the maps they're about has been endlessly satisfying. So, if you're standing in a bookshop, flicking through the pages of this book, deciding whether to buy it, and let's face it, if you've read this far, the shopkeeper is probably now giving you evils, hopefully you'll find these stories a mixture of enlightening, fascinating, and silly, while one or two might accidentally teeter into thought-provoking. Above all, we hope the following chapters will lead you to agree with a view we feel more strongly about than ever before. The worst maps are the best maps.
Now, you mentioned the copyright problem with maps and the trap streets and paper towns. I believe one of those paper towns actually became real.
Yes, it did. The story
or did
is,
it?
There was a... Well, we looked into it. It's not as easy. It's not a simple story as...
It was like a Hall of Mirrors, this one, wasn't it?
The story most people are familiar
with.
Truth
and mythology that we had to unpick.
Yeah. Now, the basic story is there was a map produced of New York State by a map publisher that was working for Esso. So back in the... For most of the 20th century, you could pick up a road map from any American gas station for free. And all of those maps were made by a company called General Drafting. And they put a paper town, a fake place called Aglo, in the middle of nowhere. And it was a made-up town. It was made out of the names. It was made out of the initials of the map makers, A-G-L-O-E. Brilliant made-up name for a town. Problem was, 30 years later, Aglo then turned up on a Rand McNally map, a rival publisher. So straight away, the publishers got in touch and said, hang on, we've caught you red-handed. Aglo's fake. And Rand McNally retorted and said, actually... No, it's not. There is an Aglo. If you go there, you will find there is an Aglo General Store. And that actually turned out to be true, because what happened was some people built a store in what they thought was the middle of nowhere. They then looked at the map and realized that, oh, there's a town here where apparently we're in Aglo. So let's call it the Aglo General Store. And so overnight, the paper town became a real town. And it meant that Esso couldn't sue Rand McNally, because you can't prove it's a trap street if it's a real place. But then... The plot thickens. We looked into it, and it turns out that the very famous Aglo General Store might never have actually existed, and that story might in itself be a trap. There was an Aglo Fishing Lodge, which had its name changed very hastily after buying the land for just $1. So it's quite possible that Rand McNally did steal the data from Esso, but no one can prove it. It turns out to be a very difficult deep-dive detective story that we never quite solve in the chapter. We just sort of explore all the different ways it maybe did or didn't happen. But either way, it's a map of a wrong place.
Yeah, buying the fishing lodge for $1 was possibly cheaper than a lawsuit, so...
It was bought by a company, wasn't it, called Aglo Associates, slightly suspiciously.
Yeah, what makes it so suspicious?
Named.
Yeah, the land was called Aglo Associates, but they had that name before purchasing the land, which is very suspicious.
I've got some questions written down, some of which are just notes. I wonder if you can comment on this. Guy Bullard, Derivy, just pub crawls, ?
These are some French words. This must be the chapter about the French movement, the Situationists, and their very, very strange ideas about maps.
This was one of the really... really fun. I mean, this, I suppose, is a sort of an intentional wrongness on maps as well, isn't it, Jay? It falls under that category. I mean, basically, as we were sort of thinking about different types of chapters we could do, I had this sort of back of my mind memory, because I studied geography at university, and one of the modules I did was called the Philosophy of Geography, which was a real module. And I just sort of had this distant memory of one of my philosophy of geography teachers saying something about a group of people who intentionally used maps of the wrong city, maps of one city, to navigate a different city. Like a lot of the philosophy of geography module, it went completely over my head until the moment where Jay and I were sitting down to talk about different bad map ideas. I'm sure there was a group of people who used maps of one city to navigate other cities. And I have to figure out who this was and learn about it. It turns out it's this group of French sort of social theorists, I suppose, from the 1960s called the Situationists. They were sort of an anti-capitalist group at their heart who just loathed the fact that the way they saw the world was that everything was dictated to them by business and commercial interests, capitalism, essentially, something they called the spectacle. And they wanted to resist that. They wanted to find new ways of living, original thought, original experiences that were sort of the antithesis of everything capitalism was telling them to do. So one of the ways they did this was through the dérive, as it was called, which is basically called the French word for a drift. And they would try to sort of experience towns and cities in new ways by exploring the parts that generally they weren't being told to visit. The strange alleyways and the dark places, I think, is maybe I'm paraphrasing, but almost a quote. And one of the ways they decided to do this was by using maps of one city to navigate another city. And so Jay and I went on a little field trip for our book, didn't I? I think Jay was incredibly skeptical when I first pitched this to him. I was like, we need to use a map of Paris to navigate London and try and meet up for lunch. And Jay, quite rightly, kept asking questions like, how's that going to work? Why are we doing that? And what do you mean? And I was very excited by it. But I think then the reality of it was our expectations were each confounded, weren't they, Jay?
I ended up having a lovely time. I mean, on paper, it does sound like a staggering waste of time to try and find each other using a map of Paris in London. But what I ended up doing was, so I started my journey. We drew a dot on the map of Paris, which was on the Champs-Élysées, right in the middle. Let's both find our way to what we think counts as the Champs-Élysées in London. And my tactic was to start my journey at the International Station, because that's one of the few things that there is definitely an equivalent of in Paris. And I walked out of St. Pancras and I stopped the London tourist information people, which is something I would never normally do, by the way. I think that's in the spirit of the challenge. And I showed them my map of Paris and I asked them, I'm trying to get to here. Can you tell me which is the best way to go? And the astonishing thing was, this guy who works for Transport for London, it's his job to know the city well. And he didn't realize it was the wrong map. He confidently gave me directions, which, of course, I had to follow. And that was my tactic throughout, to just stop and ask people and see if I can find equivalents. And by the end of it, you know, it was a bizarre, complete waste of time and a weird thing to do. And of course, Mark and I did not find each other. We were nowhere near. But
nowhere
by
near.
The end of it, I felt like I knew London better and I felt like I knew Paris better as well.
Whereas I had the opposite experience.
I didn't get lunch and I was very hungry.
Well, I had the opposite experience. I had this romantic notion that I was going to become a situationist for a day and that I was going to discover different parts of London and get lost and sort of experience something different. And instead, by trying to follow the map in the way that the Paris map to get to where I thought the Champs-Élysées was essentially, I just ended up walking sort of around in circles around southeast London. And I know southeast London very well. That's sort of where that's the part of London I live in anyway. And I literally was walking past a place I used to live. I was walking past cafes I go to. I could see the Shard the entire time. And so I never felt like I had lost my bearings, which was a shame because that was actually the part that I really wanted to experience, that sort of, you know, sense of discovery or anonymity or whatever. But instead, I didn't get that. So I went in with high hopes and was disappointed. And Jay went in with very low expectation and was pleasantly surprised.
I think that's a good tip for life. Keep your expectations very low. You'll always be very pleasantly surprised.
No, it's not usually that an audiobook will break the fourth wall.
Chapter 10, The Deadly Shortcut. Now,
yes,
before...
We should explain. So the chapter you're about to listen to...
it's different.
This chapter takes the form of the transcript of an audio podcast. So in the print version, it's a description of something that you can hear. But in the audiobook version that you're listening to, we're going to describe for you the print version that describes a podcast. So, for example,
Layers
within layers. So, for example, whenever there's a sound effect, for example, there is the sound of footsteps. Instead of actually hearing footsteps, you're going to hear us read sound effect footsteps.
But I am not against the idea of, well, look, we've got a microphone. I could read that. And you, why don't you try to do it so you can be our live Foley artist?
Or like make footstep noises.
Make footstep noises, and yeah, are you up for that?
Yeah, like, why
you
not?
Don't,
why
you
not?
Don't,
okay.
You don't have the worst deal here, do you? Let's face it. Because
the other
thing that's going to become apparent immediately is that I will be testing out my New York American accent on on you, the listener, and on Jay and Alex, who's in the studio, and we'll just see what comes out.
We were writing this book, and I said to Mark on several occasions, what are we going to do about the audiobook? And Mark said every time, you know what? Don't worry. We'll just deal with that when it happens. And that moment when it happens is right now.
Yeah. It, the American accent, it wasn't a problem when it was on the page.
So, come with us on a journey where you're hearing an audio description of a print book description of an audio podcast. Take it away.
Okay.
So how was it translating quite a visual book into an audiobook? And I must say, you don't need the maps to enjoy this book. I never looked at the dossier once. I enjoyed the book thoroughly. You know, you can enjoy it without the visual aspect of the maps. But how was it turning this quite visual book into an audiobook?
Well, first of all, can I just say that really good to hear you say that you did enjoy it without looking at the dossier once, because the audiobook, some listeners may know, but they tend to come, if there are sort of pictures and images in it, they often do come with a PDF with a few images attached. So we just selected a handful of the ones that we felt were most useful for giving context. But we did always try to write the book with the audiobook in mind, for sure. And the idea that if there was a map that was important, that we were describing with words what it looked like and, you know, the key features of it, and not just assume that people have paid attention to the right bit of the map if they are looking at it. So, yeah, we were always very aware of the audiobook. We knew from the beginning that we were going to be recording one together, and we always look forward to that. I think, you know, obviously our day job is more performative than a book generally is. So I think we always had in our minds the audiobook. And I have to give credit here. And Jay had it in his mind a lot more. I think Jay is a much...
Well, I'm a big consumer of audiobooks, because I really enjoy listening to audiobooks either when I'm driving or cycling or trying to fall asleep. And so I've got this... it's why I had the audiobook in mind from the start. And like some of the chapters that I was working on, I didn't think to include anything visual, because I thought, well, this has to work in a format that you can just read without relying on the pictures. And so what it meant was we ended up with a book that actually translated to audiobook surprisingly easy. One of the books that I listened to most recently before starting work on this one was John Ellidge's book, History of the World in 47 Borders, which, again, you would think, because it's all about maps, that it would require a visual element to understand what's going on, but it absolutely doesn't. And just like our book, it came with a PDF attachment of the images, and I found myself not needing to look at them at all. So, yeah, it was absolutely possible to translate the book into audiobook form, apart from chapter 10.
Well, that's why we've got that little bit you just played where we do break the fourth wall. It was an absolute necessity, because chapter 10 was the one that we were always like, oh, okay, well, we'll have to cross the audiobook bridge when we get there a little bit, because it was written, without giving too much away, but it was written as a podcast transcript. So obviously, if you're reading the book, the thing you're reading is the transcript of a podcast. But when you're recording the audiobook, well, you're not quite listening to a podcast. You're listening to a reading of
irony,
a transcript of an audiobook. Now, we did. That's why we kind of said we'll break the fourth wall. We'll sort of make a bit of a thing of that. And Jay ends up sort of, because what was written was things like sound effects and ox wails. So we were like, well, what do we do? Do we actually sort of record, try and get a sound engineer to create these sound effects for us and mix it? Or do we just get Jay to be the sound effects Foley artist throughout? And when an ox has to wail, Jay has to do the sound effect. And we opted, I think quite rightly, for the latter option. But I don't think the joke was all on Jay, because meanwhile, I had to read the entire thing in an American accent. And let's just say, I did my best.
A slow and melancholy melody played on a lone cello is joined by some light, sparse, high-pitched piano notes, adding mystery and intrigue to the bass note of gravity. Slight music fade as the voice of Caleb Carter pushes through the enticing theme. Caleb has a strong New York accent and speaks with a confident self-assurance, as if he's really done his research. His voice conveys a studied honesty. You know he's not exaggerating the facts, because he practically throws them away with an insouciant, if not highly derivative, vocal fry. Caleb. What would it take for you to eat another human being? Sound effects. Frontier marching drums. Extreme hunger. A vendetta. Curiosity. Perhaps you think you would never, under any circumstances, eat someone. But then, can you really know that about yourself? I'm not sure I can.
It's a very good accent. Angie, I was going to comment, your Scottish accent's quite passable as well.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, possibly slightly cartoony.
So the Scottish accent, I was trying very specifically to do Ivor Cutler when he's doing his Life in a Scotch Sitting Room series. So and I listened to it back, and the engineer had provided this backing music, which, like, oh, that's a bit too spot on. Like, this isn't a parody. This is copying. But, like, I was very, very pleased with the end result. And to hear someone from Scotland say that I didn't do too bad of a job, that's a great relief.
And
there are quite a lot of accents we've had to do in the whole book. So I had to do Scottish for Mungo Park. Mark and I both had to do like a tough New Yorker.
I'm still waiting for a New Yorker to give me the vindication that mine was passable.
I enjoyed doing the extremely hammy German for the Albrecht Penck chapter towards the end.
Yeah.
It was inspired by Dr. von Gooswing from Count Duckula, really.
Like, Mungo Park was the most Scottish name I'd heard until Tavish Scott turned up.
Yes.
Sort of unrelated, but there is a street in Edinburgh that we mention in the book in passing that has the name East Scotland Street Lane. And that name has always... I lived there once when I was there for the Edinburgh Festival, and I've always thought the name of that street sounds like somebody trying to make up the name of a Scottish street without being able to think of one on the hoof. Oh, where do you live? Oh, East Scotland Street Lane. And wouldn't you know, it really is a place.
21st of May, 1795. Upon stepping forth from the front door of the Association of Africa's office in London, bound for Portsmouth, I was splashed immediately by a passing horse. The mire drenched my coat and breeches and penetrated my eyes and mouth. While searching my pockets for a handkerchief, an unexpectedly icy gust of wind did congeal the mud into the whites of my eyes before I could cleanse them. Temporarily blinded, I managed with some difficulty to beckon a small boy and ask him for directions to Waterloo Station. The boy informed me in the local Cockney dialect, which I had spent the prior week studying, that the steam locomotive wouldn't be invented for another 9 years, nor Waterloo Station for another 53. I thanked him for his kindness, and offered him my shoes as a parting gift. He declined them, but I left them in the street for him to pick up later, in case he changed his mind.
This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters by Mark Cooper-Jones and Jay Foreman, the Map Men. And guys, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Pleasure to talk to you.
We'll have more from the Map Men next week, and we'll also hear The Books of My Life from Mark Cooper-Jones after we take a second visit to the RNIB library.
All We Want for Christmas by Philippa Ashley was given to us by Penguin Random House.
Lara gazed up at the fells in sheer amazement. The first snow of the Lakeland winter had arrived at Ravendale Castle, dusting the trees with icing sugar and adding snowy hats to the statues in the gardens. She crunched across the cobbled courtyard that led to the front of the castle. Here the view was even more spectacular, with white-robed mountain peaks soaring into a sky of washed-out winter blue. It was a scene of perfection, and, if Lara had her way, snow would always fall exactly like this. Just enough to look pretty, without causing any disruption. However, as she was painfully aware, the weather in this remote part of the lakes had never run to plan. Rather like her life.
At Cravendale Castle, nestled in the snowy heart of the Lake District, Lara is busy preparing for the Winter Spectacular, a glittering light trail that will fill the grounds with the magic of Christmas. It's the perfect distraction from her recent heartbreak until Flynn, the ruggedly handsome technical manager, arrives and sparks start to fly. Flynn is determined to prove he's worth taking a chance on. But just as Lara begins to believe in love again, someone from Flynn's past arrives at the castle, bringing a secret that could tear them apart. As Christmas draws closer, can Lara and Flynn take a leap of faith towards the happily ever after they've always wanted?
At least today the snow had made its entrance, with perfect timing for the Christmas at the Castle tour that would mark the start of the festive events programme at Ravendale. The previous autumn, Lara had landed her dream job as manager of this medieval castle, tucked away in a remote corner of the Lake District. and it had been her idea to run the tours, offer festive afternoon teas, and create a Christmas tree tour through the castle's principal rooms. The highlight of the event's programme would be the Winter Spectacular, a fantastic light trail that would illuminate the grounds and hopefully draw in thousands of visitors. Her fingers were firmly crossed, however, because the previous month, a major glitch had threatened to derail their plans. Gerald, the well-loved castle maintenance manager, had gone on long-term sick leave, and there was no sign of him returning. In fact, rumours had started to circulate that he might retire, though nothing official had been announced yet. His absence had been sorely felt, and meant that Lara had taken on the job of liaising with the illuminations contractors directly. On top of all her other duties as curator and events manager, it had been a big strain. Her history degree hardly qualified her as an electrical expert.
All We Want for Christmas by Philippa Ashley is narrated by Charlotte Worthing and runs for 10 hours and 49 minutes.
The Christmas Retreat by Trish Ashley was donated by Penguin Random House.
The Spanish flu was no respecter of youth or strength. It preyed on the young and healthy as avidly as on the frail and elderly. My mother had been a good 20 years younger than Papa, a tall, sturdy, fair Yorkshire woman, full of vitality. Yet her life blew out like a snuffed candle within days of contracting the vile illness. Papa, shattered by her loss, did not even try to put up any resistance. After his death, I discovered that he had given some thought to what might happen to me, his only child, although when the solicitor, Mr. Brown, explained things to me after the funeral, I wished he had not. Mr. Brown, a small, wiry man with frizzled hair the colour of dust and with eyes to match, accompanied us back to my lodgings, together with my friend Millie, who was staying with me, and Mama's friend Mrs. Clark, who had been providing support and good advice. There, once Mrs. Clark had made tea and then tactfully retired, the solicitor proceeded to explain things to me.
Ginny Spain usually loves Christmas. Not this year, though. After witnessing a traumatic accident and breaking up with her ex, she plans to spend it alone. But her formidable art historian mother, Evie, has other ideas. Determined to drag her daughter out of isolation, Evie persuades Ginny to spend Christmas with her at an artist and writer's retreat at Triskillion, a remote old house in the tiny coastal village of Little Star. But Evie's plans aren't without an ulterior motive. Having discovered that her grandmother was an artist and spent time at Triskillion House, she wants to unlock the secrets surrounding her and Ginny's ancestor. Rugged Rhys Tarn lives at Triskillion with his 10-year-old daughter, having lost his wife in mysterious and distressing circumstances. And Ginny is in for a shock when she discovers she and Rhys share an unexpected connection. Between winter solstice and Twelfth Night, and with the help of Rhys, can Ginny unlock her past and make this Christmas her happiest one yet?
I have your father's will here, Miss Madoc, which is a simple document stating that once all debts have been repaid, the residue of his estate goes to you. Since, as I have already informed you, most of his income derived from an annuity, which ceased at his death, I am afraid there will be very little money left over, even after everything is sold. I knew about the annuity, and of course, with his deteriorating health over the last couple of years, his portrait commissions had dwindled, I said. I did not add that ever since I turned 14 and the tremor in Papa's hands had begun to be a problem, I myself had taken an increasing role in completing the final details of his portraits, for I had a great facility for copying any style of painting or artist. In Papa's case, while he was still much influenced in his work by the impressionist style of his youth, he was not unaware of the various more avant-garde groups of young painters that had sprung up around us in London. A post-impressionism exhibition he had taken me to in 1910 had inspired great admiration in my young mind, and he had also frequently let me accompany him on visits to the studios of his friends. Of course, I had no desire to pursue a career as a mere copyist, for I aspired to develop my own style and become an artist in my own right, and to this end had been studying at the Slade School of Art for the last 2 years, since I was 16, although I had been largely absent since Mama died in February.
The Christmas Retreat by Tricia Ashley is narrated by Catherine Press and runs for 12 hours and 55 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
I asked for some book recommendations in Books of My Life from both of the Map Men, and today it's Mark Cooper Jones. Mark, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Well, I really vividly remember reading The Hobbit faster than I think I had read anything up to that point and being totally, totally captivated. I think sort of by its darkness as well. I mean, obviously there's the world building and there's the story and the narrative, but like I was sort of scared of it. I can't remember what age I was when I read it, maybe 8 or something, but I just sort of had this terror as I read it, but I was completely gripped at the same time. So that has always really, like, that memory is very etched.
Up jumped Bilbo and, putting on his dressing gown, went into the dining room. There he saw nobody, but all the signs of a large and hurried breakfast. There was a fearful mess in the room and piles of unwashed crocks in the kitchen. Nearly every pot and pan he possessed seemed to have been used. The washing up was so dismally real that Bilbo was forced to believe the party of the night before had not been part of his bad dreams, as he had rather hoped. Indeed, he was really relieved to think that they had all gone without him and without bothering to wake him up, but never a thank you, he thought. And yet, in a way, he could not help feeling just a trifle disappointed. The feeling surprised him. "Don't be a fool, Bilbo Baggins," he said to himself, "thinking of dragons and all that outlandish nonsense at your age." So he put on an apron, lit fires, boiled water, and washed up. Then he had a nice little breakfast in the kitchen before turning out the dining room. By that time, the sun was shining and the front door was open, letting in a warm spring breeze. Bilbo began to whistle loudly and to forget about the night before. In fact, he was just sitting down to a nice little second breakfast in the dining room by the open window when in walked Gandalf.
"My dear fellow," said he, "whenever are you going to come? What about an early start? And here you are, having breakfast or whatever you call it at 10:30. They left you the message because they could not wait."
"Well, what message?" said poor Mr. Baggins, all in a fluster.
"Great elephant," said Gandalf, "you are not at all yourself this morning. You have never dusted the mantelpiece."
"What's that got to do with it? I've had enough to do with washing up for 14.
"If you had dusted the mantelpiece, you would have found this just under the clock," said Gandalf, handing Bilbo a note written, of course, on his own notepaper. This is what he read. "Thorin and company to burglar Bilbo greeting. For your hospitality, our sincerest thanks, and for your offer of professional assistance, our grateful acceptance. Terms, cash on delivery, up to and not exceeding 1/14 of total profits, if any. All travelling expenses guaranteed in any event. Funeral expenses to be defrayed by us or our representatives, if occasion arises and the matter is not otherwise arranged for. Thinking it unnecessary to disturb your esteemed repose, we have proceeded in advance to make requisite preparations and shall await your respected person at the Green Dragon Inn, Bywater, at 11 a.m. sharp, trusting that you will be punctual. We have the honour to remain yours deeply, Thorin and Co."
"That leaves you just 10 minutes. You will have to run," said Gandalf.
"But
said Bilbo. No time for it, said the wizard. But, said Bilbo again, no time for that either. Off you go!
That's Andy Serkis reading from The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. It's available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and braille, and there's also a dramatised audio version. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily go back to and reread?
I really thought about this. I'm not very good at reading books again. I think I always want to read something I haven't read, but the one that is always in my mind to reread, the first one I will reread, I think, will be Money by Martin Amis. I think I really like books that try to do something different, quite high concept, take a big swing, and obviously I like it if they pull that off. And I think Money is a really good example of that. There's this really distinct narrative voice to it that is funny and awful, and just, I remember reading that thinking, I have never read something like this. I don't know where he pulled it out from, but yeah, if you haven't read Money, it's a terrible portrayal of a human being, and I loved it.
There's only one good way to get good at fighting. You have to do it a lot. The reason why most people are no good at fighting is that they do it so seldom. And in these days of high specialisation, no one really expects to be good at anything unless they work out at it and put in some time. With violence, you have to keep your hand in. You have to have a repertoire. When I was a kid growing up in Trenton, New Jersey, and later on the streets of Pimlico, I learned these routines one by one. For instance, can you butt people, i.e. hit them in the face with your face? A very intimate form of fighting with tremendous power to appall and astonish. I took up butting when I was 10. After a while, after butting a few people, you try to hit them with your rug line, hit them in the nose, mouth, cheekbone, it doesn't much matter. I thought, yeah, I can butt people now. From then on, butting people was suddenly an option. Ditto with shin kicking and eye forking. There were all new ways of expressing frustration, fury and fear, and of settling arguments in my favour. You have to work at it, though. You learn over the years by trial and error. You can't get the knack by watching TV. You have to use live ammunition. So, for example, if you ever tangled with me and a rumble developed, and you tried to butt me, to hit my head with your head, you probably wouldn't be very good at it. It wouldn't hurt. It wouldn't do any damage. All it would do is make me angry. Then I'd hit your head with my head extra hard, and there would be plenty of pain, and maybe some damage too. Besides, I'd probably butt you long before it ever occurred to you to butt me. There's only one rule in street and bar fights. Maximum violence, instantly. Don't pussyfoot. Don't wait for the war to escalate. Nuke them right off. Hit them with everything. Milk bottle, car tool, clenched keys or coins. The first blow has to give everything. If he takes it and you go down, then you get all he has to mete out anyway. The worst, the most extreme violence at once. Extremity is the only element of surprise. Hit them with everything. No quarter.
Money, A Suicide Note by Martin Amis is available in the RNIB Talking Book Library as read by Robert Ashby. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but you've read it recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend?
I've just realised that all mine are quite dark, actually. I mean, The Hobbit's not that dark, I suppose, but I read a non-fiction book by someone called Richard Lloyd Parry, who used to be a Times journalist, and specifically for a long time was a Times journalist. It was a Japan correspondent, and he wrote a book called The People Who Eat Darkness, and it is about the case of Lucy Blackman, who was tragically murdered in Japan decades ago, and then the sort of fallout of that. But he gets inside that story like nobody else. He spent years and years with the families and obviously knows the workings of Japan inside out. And it's the narrative, what happened to Lucy was terrible, but the narrative of the criminal case was absolutely gripping. And I'm not in any way a true crime junkie, but more fascinating to me was what that was able to tell you about the way Japan works, its police system, its jurisdiction system, social questions, cultural questions. It really opened up a country that I actually don't know a huge amount about. So that is the best non-fiction book I think I've ever read, The People Who Eat Darkness.
Lucy wakes up late, as usual. A line of daylight flares at the edge of the shrouded window and pierces the dim interior. A low, cramped, colourless space. There are posters and postcards on the walls, and blouses and dresses on overburdened hangers. On the floor, two human shapes on two futon mattresses, one head of blonde hair, one of brown. They sleep in T-shirts or naked beneath a single sheet, for even at night it is too hot and clammy for anything but the thinnest layer against the skin. Outside, crows are cawing and scuffling on the telegraph wires that tangle between the buildings. It was 4 in the morning when they went to sleep, and the plastic alarm clock shows that it is almost noon. The brown head remains huddled on its pillow as Lucy puts on her dressing gown and goes to the bathroom. She refers to her home in Tokyo as the house. The bathroom is one of the reasons why. 6 people share it, plus their overnight guests, and the room is vile with their parings and detritus. Exhausted tubes of toothpaste curl on the edges of the sink. Sodden lumps of soap drool on the floor of the shower, and the plug hole wears a slimy cap of clotted hair, skin, and toenail clippings. Lucy's own vanity products, which are numerous and expensive, are brought into and removed from the bathroom on every visit, along with her combs, brushes, and makeup. Her toilet is lengthy and fastidious, a practiced drill of shampooing, rinsing, conditioning, soaping, toweling, patting, smoothing, cleansing, moisturizing, absorbing, tweezering, brushing, flossing, and blow-drying. Lucy epitomizes the distinction between simply taking a shower in the morning and grooming. If you were running late, you wouldn't want to find yourself behind her in the queue for the bathroom.
People who eat darkness. Love, Grief, and A Journey into Japan's Shadows by Richard Lloyd Parry is available commercially, as narrated by Simon Vance. That's all we've got time for on today's Read On. We'll have more from the Map Men at the same time next week, and we'll hear the Books of My Life from Jay Foreman. We'll also explore A Tactile Map from RNIB, ask why it's good to be lost, and hear about another audiobook narrated by Jay. All that and much, much more on next week's Christmas with the Map Men special on Read On Something.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.